Who is Hugh Hendry?
The acid capitalist.
What is acid capitalism? We are governed by elitists, and they believe in some preposterous notion of hard money. What is hard money? You know, they just create hard lives. It's a conspiracy of the elites to bring down, you know, the good folk. And we live in an era of compounding policy errors, which creates this notion of a depression. The thing that the global economy requires is higher wages, but they spend all their time trying to stop wages rising. Am I a Marxist?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, it becomes inevitable, but just now, capitalism is trying to push back. We are in the midst of a creeping depression. And when you have these depressions where the economy grows very slowly and doesn't reward the good folk, people worry about the notion of a permanent plateau. And so they spend their time thinking about the redistribution of income rather than expanding income. I'm still in the camp that I think we got legs. I think we can do better. I think we will do better.
We'll get onto depression later, but I want to start with, how did the son of a truck driver from the mean streets of Glasgow end up on a tropical island? Please tell us a little of your life story, your career, and how the acid capitalist came to be.
Serendipity. To quote the Fontaines DC from Dublin, now based in London, the most rocking band in the world. My childhood was small, but I'm living it big now. I can't explain it. You know, I got passion, serendipity, and angels on. I got angel wings, and somehow it all came together. I was fortunate that I got a job as an investment analyst at the age of 21 in Edinburgh. I was a cultural experiment for that organization. I got a good training. I moved to London. Against serendipity, I met a controversial hedge fund manager, and he taught me to be curious, to misbehave. Misbehavior sounds not an appropriate word given the charge sheet against this fellow these days. But he cultivated risk taking within me, and we're talking 23 years ago, when no one had really heard of hedge funds, and you know, it was my calling, and so I made some money, and I got exhausted, and hedge fund management became joyless, and I moved to a very beautiful island in the Caribbean.
Brilliant. You were talking about misbehaving, and post 2008, you appeared on BBC and various other UK broadcast media. Many of the clips can still be found on YouTube, which I really do recommend viewers listening to this. After you've finished, go watch them.
Well, how long have we been at this? How long has this Greek question been on the table? About 10 weeks, maybe?
I mean, I don't know. Was Jeffrey skiing 2 months ago? Because I was working and Gillian was working, right? So we can tell you about the real world, because it doesn't look like 2 months ago.
That's just ridiculous.
This is preposterous. To say that this started 10 weeks ago is the height of absurdity, right?
And we're going to stop your attacks. Okay. On ordinary people's future.
Mr. Rasmussen, are you worried, Hugh Hendry?
He should be worried. These champagne socialists, yeah? When I travel business class, I meet these guys. I meet these socialists, yeah? These socialists who travel business and first class through the prosperity created by entrepreneurs and risk takers like me and the people that I represent. Now, we are confronted, our society today is confronted with a bleak future owing to poor policy decisions. The truth today has become unpalatable.
What made you retreat from the spotlight? You became almost a B-list celebrity in UK culture post great financial crisis. Were you just fed up, or was there other reasons?
Well, I guess B's better than C. I was one of very few market participants that correctly, foresaw the storm, which was so devastating in 2008. And the journey was just very exhausting. The way the government seemed to want to punish the truth tellers, you know, short selling bans, etc. And so I made a lot of money. To quote the DZ Von Dunes, I'm about to make a lot of money. But I was angry and I wanted to go on TV, and I was kind of quoting the former Treasury Secretary of America in the late 1920s, Andrew Mellon, who has a famous quote, let's effectively liquidate stocks, liquidate labor, liquidate the whole damn thing. Let's clean out this rotten kind of whorehouse type thing. And I wanted to give voice to my community, the community that had seen it, the community that had been ignored, and to tell another story, because back then the people who were discovering the truth were actually then being labeled as the people who had brought it on and created the crisis. And hedge funds are secretive, and so it would lend itself to that misinformation. And so in my naivete, I was the only one willing to speak. I gave up because I'm very pessimistic on the politics of today, the caliber of the people, but largely, I believe that economic history changed 25 years ago. I was dismayed by how changes in the global economy brought about by the rise of China and its engagement with the rest of the world. We call it mercantilism. And the industrialization of the Chinese economy is something I welcome. But it's being financed in a manner which spreads pain and poverty to the rest of the world. And the politicians, and perhaps more particularly their policy advisors, have yet to grasp the significance of that. And we live in an era of compounding policy errors, which creates this notion of a depression. And boy, did I try, but I got fed up trying. Maybe I'm back trying. Maybe the phoenix-like rise of the asset capitalist is me trying again, but there is a profound degree of inconsistency that I'm trying from my exclusive, beautiful beach island that no one can afford to come, and I'm kind of saying, hey, bring the system down again. So maybe I'm just an anarchist. I don't think so, but anyway.
Well, I hope the spirit inside you has been rekindled somewhat to make your triumphant return to media presenting and appearing on various broadcast media. You mentioned depression. You mentioned it earlier and you've just mentioned it again. Now, I have a narrative I want you to give me your opinion on. I'm 22 years old, and for the vast majority of my life, I believe we have lived in an economic depression, a depression in the sense that we never regained our pre-2008 growth rate trend. The US is approximately missing a cumulative $40 trillion of its GDP since 2008. And all these political problems that you'd previously mentioned, plaguing and polarizing our society, I think can be attributed to a prolonged lack of that growth. Hugh, what's your take on that narrative? And please feel free to call me a moron.
Well, the people, I spent the majority of my time claiming that I was an oxymoron rather than a moron. The oxymoron would be the notion that I was a trend following contrarian. But to answer and to take head on your narrative, that's the narrative of asset capitalism. Kind of like the 35-year trend growth rate in GDP up until 2007, 2008 for kind of Western economies was about 3.5%. We've been nowhere near that. And so if you will, if you extend that trend forward, we're kind of way below it. And that's the cumulative 40 trillion that you refer to. Why is that happening? I more than hinted at it. 40 years ago, or just under, but like 1994, the US signed the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada. On that day, or on, you know, in that timeline, the Chinese chose to devalue their currency. The Chinese currency was trading at 6.5. You needed 6.5 red cabbages to buy one US dollar. Today, when you imagine everything which has gone so well for the Chinese economy, the notion of economics, and you know, take a step back, what is economics? Economics is largely the pursuit, the investigation, the observation of a system seeking equilibrium. And its equilibrium has not been restored. The disturbance of bringing on a gigantic nation, that nation 35, 37 years ago was at the GDP of Turkey. Today it has the GDP of the continent of Europe is $18 trillion. The citizens of China should be wealthier, which is to say the currency should require less red cabbage, less of their currency to buy a US dollar. If that was the case, the premise would be that richer Chinese citizens would be buying British goods and services. But the Chinese government, it's not just the Chinese, the Brazilians, the Germans, the Japanese, the South Koreans, Taiwan, et al. Rather than buying goods and services, what did they do? They buy financial assets. You know, so all of the hysteria about, and rightfully there should be a degree of hysteria about this, the perilous nature of the UK economy. Sovereign nations will continue to buy British risk-free assets because that's what they do. They do it to contain their currencies from rising. But it leaves us, it takes us down a path of serfdom. You know, it impoverishes the common folk. And then to add to that great horror, central banks don't understand this. They think there's going to be a wage price spiral. And so they're jacking up interest rates to kind of, the thing that the global economy needs is higher rates. And the thing that central banks are fighting is higher wages. The thing that the global economy requires is higher wages. But they spend all their time trying to stop wages rising. That's a folly. It's going to create a revolution.
We've spoken about Marx, we've spoken about revolution. Is there any way to stop it? Would closing European and US capital accounts down to Asian and all these mercantilist nations, would it stop the inevitable revolution if it is inevitable? The class warfare that is brewing every day?
It requires, there's kind of two ways you can go. You can you could charge sovereign nations a tax on buying British gilts, but largely this works at the US level. The UK is a bit player in this. If the US administration turned around and had a withholding tax of between, I don't know, 3 or 15% on Chinese purchases of risk-free treasuries, then they would lose the mechanism. The mechanism which creates high asset prices and low wages. But the consequences of that decision would be an almighty economic recession. Really, really, really nasty. But my point is, we had a really nasty one 2008, 2009. And we're going to get another one. And at the end of it, it's going to be unresolved. And when it all recovers in 10 years' time, maybe 15, we'll have another. Okay, so better, I'd rather take a big nasty recession, but actually come out the other side with a resolution. But that's not going to happen. Okay, so what could happen, right, is that if play the game, what does play the game mean? I'm telling you that there are huge sovereign nations that must buy British gilts and US treasuries. Yeah. And therefore you should, the UK and the US government should be running big fiscal deficits. Now that meets a lot. There's too much fiscal conservatism. I kind of get it. Government is wasteful. I kind of get it. But I like the Biden administration and the great, I mean, it's preposterous, the title, the Great Inflation Reduction Act. But it's essentially subsidizing investment. Investment is key to the future, and subsidizing private sector investment in the US. I think the UK would do well to pursue a similar strategy and try and eliminate all of the payroll taxes that exist that make it expensive to hire labor. We want to boost wages. So that's what I would be going. The catastrophe is that in the UK, in the years 2010, 2011, the Chancellor, George Osborne at the time, chose fiscal rectitude. He sought to rein in government spending. Back then, I didn't disagree with that. We had a sovereign debt crisis in Greece and elsewhere, and it seemed a plausible reaction. But we discovered, 5-10 years later that it was unnecessary. We'd inflicted great pain, great profound pain, and again we'd depressed wages. So you can imagine my horror, my great horror, when we now have a new chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and he is proposing the same, and all of the international elite economic think tanks are all proposing the same. It's a conspiracy of the elites to bring down, the good folk.
Well, if we're not going to close down capital accounts and imposing a rent on the major surplus nations, is there a way to franchise the masses, franchise the working classes, giving them assets, things like right to buy? Are there ways in which the regular people can benefit from the constant flow of mercantilist money into our financial markets? Anyway.
Yeah, I want to say there are ways. I've been toying with the idea that the UK could go the route of Norway and have a sovereign wealth fund. The visions that I have for the next 18 months, I can see asset prices being very weak. And I would imagine that the authorities, the government, will do some kind of bailout, some rescue package, and they already have quantitative easing. But quantitative easing, I think, is just it achieves nothing. It really sounds like money printing, but it's not. But what if we were actually spending that money and buying assets for the disenfranchised, for the folk that don't have the means to actually be able to afford assets? What if we actually we had a sovereign fund and it was open? If you will, you could unitize it on the basis of your lack of wealth. So those had been unable to accumulate assets were actually, if you will, tokenized and allowed to participate, because ultimately cycle is asset prices fall a lot in the next 2 years and governments then bail them out and then asset prices go higher. Who bails them out? Everyone. That is to say the people who own the assets and the people who don't own the assets. And that's unfair. So there are ways, there are complicated ways. You could look at crypto. We had the big problem we had with crypto just now is you had the silly NFTs, which is selling bullshit kind of presumed images of monkey apes or whatever. What if, like you and here you are starting yourself out as a little social media entrepreneur? What if you could tokenize it and you could distribute tokens to the first 500 followers? And they would have effectively a share in your business, and they'd be incentivized to then go and kind of sell the message to their friends. You can't do that just now because the regulation is that you're selling a security, But, you know, I think we should be making exceptions for kids trying to create. There's a very convex, like, convexity means, you know, like, if you do it well, your returns don't rise in a linear manner, but they go off the chart in an exponential manner. And there are 8 billion smartphones in the world. I know that when my smartphone, when I lose the battery, I still look at it. I'm like, you know, entertain me, talk to me, do something. So that's the convexity. But just now again, it's serfdom because you're controlled by the algorithm of YouTube or whatever platform you find yourself on. And again, you've got someone else charging you rent for your endeavors. And what does it do for you to be successful? You're going to have a really stupid thumbnail with the stupid title. Yeah.
Don't worry, so I will.
It makes you stupid, you know.
So you were talking about quantitative easing and the ineffectiveness of it. Japan's a perfect example of that. 30 years of QE, nothing's happened. But I think you mentioned a different form of QE, a sort of people's QE. Richard Werner, who was in Japan during the bubble collapse, was, I believe, the originator of quantitative easing, and he conceptualized it in a method where it was an actual people's quantitative easing.
So the true definition of quantitative easing is to quantitatively increase credit creation in the economy for GDP transactions.
Right.
Now,
but that's very targeted, isn't it?
Yes,
and what
exactly.
Actually has happened with central banks across the world is a scattergun approach.
Exactly.
And actually, wherever you foresee a problem, whether it be banking through to a pandemic, let's have another go at QE.
Exactly. That's been the problem since 2008. The credit creation has not been targeted at those transactions that actually help the economy and contribute to the creation of wealth and lead to high, sustainable, equitable, non-inflationary growth without crises.
So what do we do with that? Do we expand central bank balance sheets to buy assets and just give them away? Or is it a fair basis, almost like a universal, everyone gets something? Are we just giving it to the working class? How does this work?
It's dear to my heart. It has to be means tested. But you mentioned quantitative easing in the context of Japan, and I don't want to blow brain fuses with the audience, but quantitative easing is effectively a bank swaps a government security, a gilt, and it's in return, its account with the central bank is credited with bank reserves. And the theory, and it's the correct theory, is that with those bank reserves, you're facilitating the ability of the banking system to lend more money. So it has a potency. It could be money, but it requires the economic agents, i.e. the banks, to be risk-seeking and to embrace that potency by making loans. The failure of quantitative easing in Japan and elsewhere is that because it came after an economic and asset price decline, the banking sector has got no desire to take risk. And so I like to think of Japan as like sitting in an igloo, like really cold. And so the cold would be the metaphor for the lack of economic growth. But with quantitative easing, you've sprayed the igloo with paraffin, and that's the potency of these bank reserves that they could create. They could be money printing, but it requires someone, you know, with an imaginary, you know, cigarette lighter, and you need someone to go, you know,
yeah.
And the whole thing, boom, okay. And what you should know is that in our world today, all the experts are thinking that Japan is really close to going poof. The Japanese yen, which has been very strong for a very long time, like for longer than you've been on this planet, is showing indications that it could get very weak. And that may be because the banking sector actually lit the match, if you will, and they use their bank reserves to borrow dollars. But dollars are scarce in China, and they lent the dollars. So effectively, they shorted the dollar. They took term risk. They took credit risk. And this is all going on behind the surface. So much going on. Like, my job is to know what's behind the curtain. And you know, the opportunity for shows like yours is to kind of to get people like me on to share some of that those visions. So keep an eye on Japan. Japan's on the edge.
Well, it seems like they've finally got the horse to drink the water after leading it to the well. Anyway, let's go to present times. We're currently at the end of a major repricing in debt. Central bank policy rates are around 5% in the West. Debt to GDP is at record levels, and our economies are built on low cost to carry debt. At current rates, are we all just dead men walking, waiting for the inevitable to break?
Yes, especially in the UK. The issue 15, 17 years ago, if you go back to 2006 or so, bankers in America went around offering free money to buy houses, you know, like 1% interest rates or whatever. And they were called teaser rates. For 2 years, you paid almost nothing. But in the third year, it would reset. And the idea was that you'd have sold the property before it reset, and you'd have made yourself a lot of money. And they didn't sell enough. A lot of people got trapped. They went from paying like 1% to 5%, and they went bankrupt. They gave the keys back to the banks. We had a failure in the banking system. The UK looks as if the exact same thing's going to happen. 80% of the mortgage stock is on fixed rate resets. About a quarter of them are resetting, I think, every 3 or 4 months.
And we had a spike in COVID times of those people taking them out. We had a huge spike, and it's about 3 years after that huge spike, which is right now, at these ridiculous rates. So,
no, you're 100% right. I mean, the government kind of encouraged risk-taking. People bought lots of assets. They bought it with, like, money that costs nothing. And then the government, or their agents, the Bank of England, I think, have completely messed up. We'll come back to why. And they're resetting rates higher and higher. They're doing so because nothing has happened so far, but they forget that the majority of mortgages are on the 2 year. Nothing happens for 2 years. Inflation is now falling. I mean, really falling rapidly, even in the UK. And then they're just, it's like you've thrown a brick on a rubber band. The brick's coming back. It's just about to hit the boom here. So I see a lot of concussion. I'm really, really worried about the UK just now.
There's no getting out of it. We've kind of dug our own grave, and now we're going to lie down in it, really.
We just had the departure of a member of the Bank of England Monetary Policy Setting Committee. And to my mind, she's something of a hero, because I think she was the only standout against raising rates. She voted against for the last six meetings. And her rationale is that if you were armed with like AI intelligence in 2021, and you could see that in the midst of the pandemic, we had an antibody which was going to work, and so within 6 or 9 months, the economy was going to recover. And if you could see that Russia was going to invade Ukraine, and that energy prices were going to go crazy to the upside, and that you knew that the UK has a very acute exposure to natural gas, that's the dominant feedstock for the energy supply, more than any other country in Europe. If you knew all of that, you would have been raising interest rates rapidly towards the end of 21 and in the first half of 20 of last year. So, like, you'd have been at 7% March last year. Okay. Now, what would be the outcome? And here's the sting in the tail. You would still have had the inflation. You would of course, you'd have had the inflation. Like the Bank of England being at 7% wouldn't stop the gas price going up. Well, the report suggests that the inflation would be identical because it is not, the inflation is exogenous to the powers of the Bank of England. It was externally imposed by, you know, an alien body invasion called COVID and by, you know, a sovereign invasion of a, almost a quasi-European nation. So rates, it's not rates, it's exogenous factors which have created a temper, like a very painful, but history will reveal a very transitory surge higher in prices.
Post-World War II, we had a similar scenario when behaviours changed and you had people coming back from the war. We had a temporary massive surge in inflation. After a year, it'd come down right to natural levels. So,
no, you're 100% well, almost 100% correct. Inflation in America touched 20%. I mean, that's huge. 20. But by 1950, it was back down at 2%. You know, it was simply all of those people coming back, those people having latent spending power, the relief joy, you know, the pandemic joy of having survived and having been, you know, you want to go on vacation and have a good time and buy stuff. All the same thing happened, you know. But we are governed by elitists, and they believe in some preposterous notion of hard money. What is hard money? You know, they just create hard lives. The Wizard of Oz was written about a time very similar in 1890, and the populist candidate William Jennings Bryan or William
the Cross Bryan, of Gold.
You know, we got to stop crucifying the common man on the cross of gold. And unfortunately, and you know, the lion depicts the populist politician. He's incredible. He's an amazing orator, but he has no power. The power is the witches in the East, and that's the banking sector, or the elitist, you know, global, the IMF, the OECD, the World Bank. And their mistakes are affecting the lives of literally billions of people on the planet.
So when is it time to get the pitchforks out and demand change in monetary policy, or at least the people who set the monetary policy? Well, how do we get those in power to realize they make mistake after mistake after mistake? And everything that they do disenfranchises and makes the average man or woman poorer. And the same with China. How do we stand up to China and say, all right, our capital account, we need to impose a sort of rent, because otherwise you are sowing the seeds of revolution by constantly making the poor poorer and the elite richer. How do we cross the Rubicon? How do we square that circle?
It's very depressing. I mean, I concluded that I have no answer to that. You know, I left. You know, look after yourself. You know, it's that whole adage, you know, there's you and your buddy. You're in the wilderness in the US and there's a bear. And you crawl down on your feet and you put on your training shoes, your running shoes, and your friend says, "What are you doing?" You're like, "I'm getting out of here fast." You know, what are you doing? I hate that term, honestly. What does that imply? That the majority of the time I'm dishonest? So I don't like that term. But I just don't see enlightenment. There is nothing in the political spectrum that gets it. The supposedly the smartest people in financial markets, they don't get it. Let me tell you, they will cut rates. They will cut rates sharply, but they will cut rates on the after the full and disastrous effect of their policy error becomes evident, and so it's too late. You know, in the MPC in the rate setting meeting of August 2008, interest rates in the UK, I think, were 5.5%. Northern Rock had gone bust. And the majority decided to hold interest rates. There was one dissenter, And he wanted to raise interest rates. Yeah. And there we were 2-3 months before like the biggest economic recession in 50 years. They cut rates and they bought bank shares, but they did it after the event and they will do the same.
So we've talked about crypto before and this whole new technological evolution. Can AI potentially provide monetary policy solutions where individuals cannot? Can we rely on an artificial intelligence and algorithms to essentially control interest rates, control capital accounts, control perhaps even politics? Are we so distrusting and fed up of error after error that we give control over to a emotionless computer?
What interest rates? We don't really need anything terribly high tech. We just have to pull ourselves away from a preposterous and historic tradition of appointing, you know, I think there are 9 MPC members in the Federal Reserve. There are 12, but like we're trying to pull together 9 or 12 wise people to make decisions. I'd rather we use the bums on seats. Bums are really intelligent. In that when I go to a foreign town, I eat in busy restaurants and I usually have a good time. There's a wisdom in the crowd. And the thing that drives me crazy is the market does a really good job at setting interest rates. Just now, the market's expectations of where interest rates are going to be or should be differs dramatically from the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve. We call that a yield curve inversion. The markets can see the devastation which is about to be brought onto the economy, and the market's saying you should be cutting rates. You're too high. And so really, I would allow the decisions of literally thousands of risk takers who have to hedge their business cash flows in the future, et cetera, but who do a great service, if you will, in price discovery. And their record in terms of seeing recessions is kind of like 10 out of 10 versus the Bank of England, which is, I don't even know if it's 1 out of 10.
And they're always very early as well. I think the yield curves have been inverted for almost 1.5-2 years now. So, well, the majority of the yield curves. So what's your plan for the future, you individually? Any progress with the brands? Any delving into new ventures, property? What's the plan for you?
I mean, I've just completed another beautiful, glorious villa on this island for, you know, it's a commercial property, it's for short-term rental. I'm continuing with the social media profile. I'm getting more and more airtime. I'm going to get more because, you know, I can see the future and I can see the bad things happening. And when it all comes down, people want to talk to the prophets. You know, I'm one of the prophets. So, my future business looks kind of good.
And after the inevitable breaking of the system, are you going to be making any reappearances on BBC or are you blacklisted?
I don't think blacklisted. I'm ignored for the present time. I do get on Bloomberg, albeit the last time I was wearing a tank, a vest, and I called it a wife beater, and they went crazy. I nearly got cancelled. So, and I don't wish to be contentious in other forms of culture. You know, my contention is within the financial and economic sphere. So that was a mistake. The BBC is a very mysterious beast, which is controlled by the Rolodexes of, you know, mysterious people, and they've yet to rediscover me. What media needs, so there's an algo for media, and they need a middle-aged guy in a suit and a tie who works for a big financial brand, and he or she comes onto their television program and looks respectable and is an expert, if you will. Experts just get it wrong. They don't invite the bums. Right? I'm a bum. So I wouldn't expect me anytime soon on the BBC, unfortunately.
I think without people like you, you'll never see the or contrarian takes or people peeking behind the curtains to see what's really going on. Instead, we're lulled to sleep in a sense of boring and totally forgettable suits who appear and say the most soft and uninviting and safe things they can say. And they always get it wrong. And then there'll be a crisis. And then they'll be back on BBC. And they'll be trying to ban short sellers or whatever they did and blame the people like yourself who peeked behind the curtain and tried to expose them. So I think we'll leave it at that. Thank you for coming on the channel. Hopefully one day I'll have you back on.
Well, best of luck. May you sail rapidly into these oceans of great good fortune, my dear young Jedi.